Autumn presents
A Critic at Large, published in the print issue of The New Yorker with the headline, Spooked. Written by Amy Davidson Sorkin. Read by January Lavoie. On January 4, 1995, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York introduced a bill called the Abolition of the Central Intelligence Agency Act. It had been a rough stretch for the CIA. The year before, Aldrich Ames, a longtime officer, had been convicted of being a longtime mole for Soviet and then Russian intelligence. Despite having a reputation among his colleagues as a problem drinker who appeared to live far beyond his means, Ames had been given high-level assignments with access to the names of American sources in the USSR. When the FBI finally arrested him, he was in the Jaguar he used for commuting to work at Langley. By then, he was responsible for the death of at least 10 agents. Moynihan said that the case was such a flamboyant display of incompetence that it might actually be a distraction from the most fundamental defects of the CIA. He meant that the agency, in what he considered to be its defining failure, had both missed the fact that the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse and done little to hasten its end. He gave a diagnosis for what had gone wrong. Secrecy keeps mistakes secret, he said. Secrecy is a disease. It causes a hardening of the arteries of the mind. He quoted John le Carré on that point, adding that the best information actually came from the likes of area specialists, diplomats, historians, and journalists. If the CIA was disbanded, he said, the State Department could pick up the intelligence work and do a better job. Moynihan was, in some respects, being disingenuous. As he well knew, even if his bill had passed, spies and spying wouldn't have gone away. The State Department already had its own mini-agency, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. The Departments of Energy and Treasury each had one, too. The Defense Intelligence Agency conducted clandestine operations. U.S. Army Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, and the Office of Naval Intelligence kept themselves busy as well. The National Security Agency was nearly two decades away from the revelation, by Edward Snowden, a contractor and a former CIA employee, that it had collected information about the phone calls of most Americans. But it was a behemoth, even in Moynihan's time. So was the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There were about a dozen agencies then. Now, after reforms that were supposed to streamline things, there are 18, including the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, a sort of meta-CIA that has a couple of thousand employees, and the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis. The Drug Enforcement Administration, which currently has foreign offices in 69 countries, has an Office of National Security Intelligence. 4 million people in the United States now have security clearances. It can be hard to sort out which agencies do what. Players in the espionage business aren't always good with boundaries. Both the CIA and the NSA make use of satellite resources, including commercial ones, but there is a separate agency in charge of a spy satellite fleet, the National Reconnaissance Office, not to be confused with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which deals with both space-based and ground-level imaging, or with Space Delta VI, the nation's newest intelligence agency, which is attached to the Space Force. Abolishing the CIA might do nothing more than reconfigure the turf wars. As the senator from New York also knew, a large proportion of the CIA's resources are devoted not to intelligence gathering, but to covert operations, some of which look like military operations. In Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American Intelligence, Princeton, one of several recent books that coincide with the 75th anniversary of the agency's founding, Amy B. Ziegart, a political scientist at Stanford, writes that it's getting harder to know just where the CIA's role ends and the military's role begins. Yet the agency's paramilitary pursuits and related covert activities go back decades. They include the botched Bay of Pigs landing, the brutal Phoenix program in Vietnam, and a long list of assassination attempts, coup plots, the mining of a harbor with explosive devices the agency built itself, and drone strikes. These operations have very seldom ended well. Moynihan's bill had no more luck than another that he introduced the same day, aimed at ending Major League Baseball's exemption from antitrust laws. In each case, people understood that there was a problem, but both institutions were protected by the sense that there was something essential and perhaps authentically American about them, including their very brokenness. A sudden turn of events can convince even the CIA's most sober critics that the agency will save us all, whether from terrorists or from Donald Trump. But 75 years in, it's far from clear whether the CIA is good at its job, or what that job is or should be, or how we could get rid of the agency if we wanted to. How did we end up with the CIA? A familiar explanation is that the shock of Pearl Harbor made the United States realize it needed more spies. The Office of Strategic Services was formed and jumped into action. And when the war ended, the OSS evolved seamlessly into the CIA, ready to go out and win the Cold War. But that narrative isn't quite right, particularly regarding the relationship between the OSS and the CIA. The United States has always used spies of some sort. George Washington had a discretionary espionage budget for which he didn't have to turn in receipts. In the early part of the 20th century, the State Department had an intelligence analysis unit, along with a cryptography group called the Black Chamber, which operated out of a brownstone in New York's Murray Hill until it was shut down in 1929. The Army and the Navy had cryptography and reconnaissance units, too. When the Second World War began, their operations ramped up dramatically, and as Nicholas Reynolds recounts in Need to Know, World War II and the Rise of American Intelligence, Mariner, these units, not the OSS, handled most of the code-breaking. The problem became the volume of raw intelligence. The task of making sense of it and of turning it into something that policymakers could use went to an office within the Army's Military Intelligence Division, or G2, which Reynolds says produced the country's best strategic intelligence during the war. That office's work was directed by Alfred McCormick, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Harlan Stone and a partner at Cravath, Swain & Moore. Many of the people he brought in were young corporate lawyers. The theory was that their training in plowing through mountains of documents made them ideal intelligence analysts. William J. Donovan, who led and largely conceived of the OSS, was also a Wall Street lawyer, but one with an aversion to the legalistic. What Donovan envisioned was essentially an array of commando units that would operate stealthily and behind enemy lines. In practice, what he tried to build, according to a colleague, was a private army. His escapades often risked too much and gained too little. In late 1943, one of his own officers wrote to him that the setup has been incredibly wasteful in manpower and, except for a few spotty accomplishments, has been a national failure. And it had produced chaos in the field. Donovan's nickname was Wild Bill, but his staff called him Seabiscuit, after the thoroughbred, because of his tendency to race around, engaging in what was basically war tourism. In the end, though, the OSS made real contributions, including through its contacts with the French Resistance. But Donovan's complaint about D-Day was that there was too much planning. Counterintelligence and strategic thinking bored him, and the OSS's analysis division was seen as secondary to its operations. When Harry Truman became president in April 1945, he took a look at the OSS, and in September 1945, abolished it. About 2 years later, he signed the National Security Act, which established the CIA and the Department of Defense, but he didn't want the new agency to be like the group Donovan had run. Instead, it was supposed to do what its name suggested: centralize the intelligence that various agencies gathered, analyze it, and turn it into something the president could use. It was not intended as a cloak-and-dagger outfit Truman later wrote. He also had to deal with public apprehensions that he might create what a Chicago Tribune headline called a super Gestapo agency, which is why, in its charter, the CIA was banned from domestic spying. Reynolds's book is the best of the recent batch, and the most readable. It does not retrofit the history of the OSS around the assumption that the CIA was the inevitable lead post-war intelligence agency. There were other contenders, including a version of McCormick's office in the State Department, something like what Moynihan wanted. J. Edgar Hoover argued that worldwide intelligence should be turned over to the FBI, with military intelligence subservient to him. In some alternative history, he might have pulled that off. By 1943, he was running undercover operations in 20 Latin American countries. And so, things could have been worse. Donovan was an adept publicist, but what mattered most in the end was that he was good, or lucky, when it came to hiring people. Despite the pale, male, and Yale stereotype, the OSS was somewhat more diverse than other units, and certainly more eclectic. Among its ranks were Ralph Bunche, Herbert Marcuse, and Julia Child. Many of its officers moved straight to the new CIA. Most consequentially, perhaps, four future directors of the CIA were OSS veterans: Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, William Colby, and William Casey. Each seems to have had glory day memories of the OSS, which is to say that each, in various ways, was afflicted with what a general in Army intelligence called the screwball Donovan effect. Casey, who put a picture of Donovan on his wall, said of his old boss, "We all glowed in his presence." Wild Bill lost the bureaucratic fight, but won the personnel and mythology wars. And of course, the agency found customers and collaborators in the White House. There was no mention of covert action in the law that chartered the CIA, but presidents, starting with Truman, began using it that way. One of the agency's first operations involved meddling in the 1948 Italian election to ensure the victory of the Christian Democrats. The subsidies and outright bribery of Italian politicians, some of them on the far, far right, continued into the 1970s. Almost from its creation, though, there was a sense that something about the CIA was off. The split between covert action and intelligence gathering and analysis was part of it. The director of the agency was also supposed to be the leader of U.S. intelligence as a whole, but invariably the person in the job seemed more invested in preeminence than in coordination. That setup remained in place until the establishment of the ODNI in 2004, a move that thus far has mostly continued a tradition of trying to deal with the CIA's dysfunction by setting up ever more agencies, offices, and centers. The NSA was established in 1952 in response to a series of cryptography-related failures. Legacy of Ashes, Tim Weiner's 2008 history of the CIA, and still an invaluable overview, takes its title from a lament by Eisenhower about what he'd be leaving his successors if the faulty structure of American intelligence wasn't changed. Since Weiner's book was published, the ashes and the agencies have only been piling up. Ziegart's Spies, Lies, and Algorithms aims to bring that history to the present. Ziegart has served as an advisor to intelligence agencies, and she provides a decent guide to our current bureaucracy. Throughout, her book is clear and well-organized. Maybe a little too well-organized, one feels, after taking in the 7 deadly biases of intelligence analysis, the 4 main adversaries and the 5 types of attack in the crypto area, and the 3 words, 4 types, that define covert action. The covert action words, incidentally, are influence, acknowledged, and abroad. Not a few paragraphs read like PowerPoint charts. Contradictions are displayed without really being reckoned with. She observes that the balance between hunting and gathering seems off, but in her telling, the fact that presidents of both parties regularly turn to the CIA for paramilitary and other covert tasks constitutes proof that doing so is part of the order of things. The impression she leaves is that if it all goes wrong, it's because some checklist has been missed. One of the top priorities of U.S. intelligence today, she thinks, should be persuading tech companies to get with the program and help out. She moots the creation of yet another agency to deal with OSINT, open source intelligence. In one chapter, Zeigart provides a list of scandals involving spying within the U.S. by various intelligence agencies, notably the NSA, the FBI, and the CIA. All of these activities violated American law, she writes. But that's the point. Domestic laws forbid this kind of surveillance of Americans. How is that the point exactly? She depicts the Senate's 2014 torture report, which detailed profound abuses in the CIA's so-called black sites, as a they said, the agency said, who knows case. She turns it into a parable about the problems with Congress, suggesting that although the committee structure may have needed rejiggering, the moral compass of those involved in the program of torture was just fine. Another new volume, A Question of Standing, A History of the CIA, Oxford, by Rhodri Jeffries-Jones, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Edinburgh, offers the insights of a more distant observer. He can be astute about how false memories of the OSS's accomplishments have led the CIA astray. Part of his argument is that the agency has acted as if its influence depended on its standing with whoever is in the White House, thus motivating it to offer presidents quick fixes that fix nothing. The net effect is to reduce its standing, and that of the U.S. with the public at home and abroad. But Jeffries-Jones is prone to rash generalizations and pronouncements. He theorizes that, in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, George W. Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, may have been susceptible to warmongering due to her status as a descendant of slaves, and that the working-class background of the CIA's director, George Tenet, made him more likely to vouch for the faulty intelligence on weapons of mass destruction used to justify the war. Social mobility so often leads to conformity, warns Jeffries-Jones, himself the son of an academic historian. During the Vietnam War, the CIA had discouraging intelligence to offer, and when successive administrations didn't want to hear it, focused on being helpful by providing those supposedly quick fixes. That meant abetting a coup in 1963, spying on anti-war protesters, and launching the Phoenix Program, an anti-Viet Cong campaign marked by torture and by arbitrary executions. In total, more than 20,000 people were killed under Phoenix's auspices. Phoenix was run by William Colby, the OSS alum who was soon promoted to CIA director. At lower levels, discontent about Vietnam fueled leaks. In December 1974, the journalist Seymour Hersh told the agency that he was about to publish a story in the Times exposing its domestic spying. Whether in a miscalculation or, as Jeffries-Jones somewhat breathlessly speculates, as an act of personal expiation, Colby gave Hersh partial confirmation. Amid the scandals and the congressional hearings that followed, Colby angered some of his colleagues and Henry Kissinger by laying bare even more. It emerged that in 1973, Colby's predecessor had asked senior agency officials to produce a list of things the CIA had done that might have been unlawful. The resulting document, covering just the prior 15 years, was known in-house as the Family Jewels and was almost 700 pages long. The question of how much it matters who works at the CIA is a perennial one. The influence of Donovan's acolytes shows that decisions about whom you recruit can, in a formative period or at a critical juncture, make a big difference. But once an institutional culture has become entrenched, it can be easier to see how the institution shapes the people within it than vice versa. Wise gals, the spies who built the CIA and changed the future of espionage, Putnam, by Nathalia Holt, comes at the question from a different angle. It's about five women who worked for the early CIA. Three also worked at the OSS, and one, Eloise Page, began her career as Bill Donovan's secretary. Holt is also the author of Rise of the Rocket Girls, about women in the early years of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and The Queens of Animation, about women at the Walt Disney Company. Her book contains fine material for a beautifully art-directed streaming series, with set pieces in post-war Paris, 1950s Baghdad, and 1970s Greece, where Paige was the CIA's first woman station chief. It even has a framing device in the form of the Petticoat Panel, a working group of CIA women that convened in 1953 to document their unequal pay and treatment. Holt quotes the transcript of the meeting at which the leadership of the agency summarily rejected their findings. Helms, the future director, says, "It is just nonsense for these gals to come on here and think that the government is going to fall apart because their brains aren't going to be used to the maximum." In 1977, Helms was convicted of lying to Congress about the CIA's machinations in Chile. What the book is not, unfortunately, is a coherent history of the CIA, of the era it depicts, or even of these women's work. Holt's research does turn up evidence that Jane Burrell, one of her subjects, was the first CIA officer to die in the line of duty, in a plane crash in France in 1948, a fact that the agency itself apparently missed. Holt ends her book with a call for a star honoring Burrell to be added to the CIA's memorial wall. Of the 137 officers represented there, she writes, 45 died accidentally, the majority in plane crashes, meaning that Burrell's case would be fairly typical. Burrell was on the return leg of a trip to Brussels, where she'd been sent to talk to war crimes investigators about a mess the CIA had created by relying on an agent who turned out to have worked with the SS and was now in custody. In that respect, too, Burrell, who had personally handled the agent, was typical of the CIA. After Burrell vouched for him, the man was released. The subject of the CIA's post-war relations with former Nazis, some of whom, like Reinhard Gehlen, it helped to install in West Germany's new intelligence service, and with collaborationist émigré groups, is no doubt a morass. Holt, alas, manages to make the story even more garbled than it has to be. In the end, she basically treats the whole sordid episode as a learning experience for the gals. The problem is that the agency doesn't seem to learn much. Holt credits Mary Hutchison with helping to build a network of émigré Ukrainian nationalists. Beginning in 1949, the agency parachuted some of them, including one whom Hutchison apparently distrusted, behind the Soviet border, where they were quickly captured, and repeated the same procedure for a number of years. Despite the catastrophe, the Ukraine operation would serve as a template moving forward, Holt writes. The CIA had more success with back-to-back operations in Iran and Guatemala, where covert action was able to deftly oust leaders considered undesirable. It's odd to describe these coups as deft. One of Ziegart's handy lists is of the unintended consequences in Iran: religious extremism, a revolutionary overthrow, the American hostage crisis, severed ties, regional instability, and today's rising nuclear dangers. Guatemala is still dealing with the violent legacy of the coup that the CIA visited upon it. Then there's the question of the intended consequences, which were respectively to elevate a Shah and a military regime. Secret wars tend not to be so secret in the country where they take place. It was, no doubt, frustrating for Hutchison when, a few years later, her colleagues on the Bay of Pigs task force failed to make use of her Spanish language skills. But are we supposed to think that the whole misconceived enterprise would have gone off without a hitch were it not for the CIA's misogyny? One of Holt's minor themes is that women in the CIA were seen as more natural analysts than operatives, with analysis, in turn, seen as less manly and less valuable, to everybody's detriment. But she is more intent on showing that these women were also daring. The main point of Wise Gals is that it's cool that women were in the early CIA, and therefore that the CIA itself was cooler than we'd realized. Holt celebrates a big promotion Paige got that afforded her access to the secret of a safe containing shellfish-derived poison. You don't have to be pale, male, and Yale to be complicit in a bungled assassination plot, or, for that matter, a program of rendition and torture. Why do so many books about the CIA have trouble getting their story straight? It can't just be the secrecy of the work itself, at least with regard to the earlier years, about which much has been declassified. Much remains under wraps. Moynihan complained that classification created more than 6 million supposed secrets in 1993. Ziegart writes that the number in 2016 was 55 million, not all of which can possibly have been critical. The aura of secrecy, by contrast, probably does distort the judgment of its chroniclers. And the scope of the agency's work is a challenge. It's hard to write expertly on places as far-ranging as the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the agency initially planned to poison President Patrice Lumumba's toothpaste, and instead ended up handing $250,000 to Joseph Mobutu, the country's future dictator, who facilitated the assassination, and Afghanistan, where the CIA has had 40 years of illusory gains and worse losses. But the biggest problem may be the agency's own pattern of self-deception. Holt, for example, sometimes seems to go wrong when, rummaging through the archives, she gives too much credit to contemporaneous internal assessments of an agent's or an operation's worth. In truth, the CIA has had a defining failure for every decade of its existence, sometimes more than one. For Moynihan in the 1990s, it was the lack of foresight about the Soviet Union. In the 2000s, it was the phantom weapons of mass destruction, followed by torture and, in still evolving ways, by the drone-based program of targeted killings with its high toll of civilian deaths. Barack Obama's rapport with John Brennan, the CIA's director from 2013 to 2017, seems to have brought him to accept the view that the killing of American citizens abroad was acceptable if managed prudently. The overuse of the agency on the battlefield is due not to a military manpower shortage, but to wishful thinking about the benefits of secrecy and of a lack of accountability. It's difficult to know at this point what the CIA's next defining failure, or if one tries to be optimistic, its stabilizing success, will be. Donald Trump has had a complicated relationship with the intelligence community, increasingly capitalized and abbreviated to IC, which is presently conducting a damage assessment regarding documents with classified markings that he kept at Mar-a-Lago, his Florida home. He might, of course, be reelected and have the CIA's tools at his disposal again. If the CIA isn't the place to turn for an expedient solution to foreign policy problems, neither is it bound to be the place to turn for a solution to our democracy's political problems. If you ask intelligence officers what misperceptions bother them most, odds are they'll mention ethics, Ziegart writes. She quotes an official who complains that people think we're lawbreakers, we're human rights violators. She insists that officers think about ethics a lot. She portrays the agency as being filled with hardworking moms and dads who do a great deal of agonizing. No doubt she's right. But if the CIA keeps falling down all the same, something must be tragically amiss in the agency's structure or culture, or both. All the talk of coups and assassination plots, Ziegart worries, distracts people from understanding the CIA's more basic intelligence mission. In fact, the party most distracted by such activities, and by the military role it has taken on, seems to be the agency itself.
If you enjoyed this production, find the best long-form articles read aloud in the Audm app, available now for iPhone and Android.